Voices of VR podcast.
Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So continuing my coverage of Augmented World Expo 2026, today's episode is with Brett Reffner of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. So Brett is really at this cutting edge of a cultural institution that is able to integrate all sorts of different dimensions of XR, augmented reality, artificial intelligence, even some blockchain gaming that he's been experimenting with, but more or less lots of different ways of trying to make the physical art that's there at the Metropolitan Museum of Art more accessible and more stories and more context. And also, if you aren't in New York City, you're able to see some of these different experiences at home with the Atopia app that they got a couple of experiences that we talk about here in this conversation. So really kind of an interesting cross-section of the different types of applications that he sees for how can you create this kind of heads-up type of experience using all these emerging technologies to deepen people's experiences at the Met, whether it's for heads-up display or gathering more information or finding new ways of telling stories in much more immersive ways. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Brett happened on Wednesday, June 17th, 2026 at the Augmented World Expo in Long Beach, California. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
I'm Brett Renfer, the Senior Project Manager of Emerging Technology at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. So XR is one of the many ways that we're looking at how emerging technology can reach new audiences and reach our existing audiences in a different way. So we just launched two projects, Tender Decoded and Oceania, A New Shape of Space and Time, that allow people to see our collection in a new way and dig into stories in XR. And then we have a small portfolio of on-site XR projects as well for people can look at. It's two sculptures in a really different way.
Great. Maybe you could give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into this space.
Absolutely. So I've been working in interactive media for a little over 20 years now, starting in actually the architectural immersive space. So hospitality, doing things in like hotels and airports, and thinking about ways that spaces can kind of be in dialogue with people. In the last 10 years, I've been working in the cultural space. And what I always say is like the shift between the two is thinking about going from like pure awe and spectacle into something that is about deep storytelling and deep content, but then try not to forget the latter, right? Like it's very easy in some ways to think about like our main goal is to educate and to really like dig into a story in a new way. But when you step into a new media or new channel, you really need that hook. You need that way to be native to the platform. So when we've been thinking about, you know, XR in general at the Met and in my kind of past projects, it's like, how do we build in that narrative, that kind of depth of the story we're trying to tell, whether it's, hey, Greek statues used to be in color and here's how we know, you know, it's science, it's our history, it's all these pieces, but do so in a way that takes advantage of the medium. So I'm a designer by trade and a technologist in practice. So, you know, I've always been in this funny mix of like coming up with ideas and then like hacking together something in code, which has gotten way easier in the XR space recently, which is great. So I've used a lot of the different platforms that have come and gone over time to kind of dig into those stories too.
Nice. And so maybe you could give a bit more of the origin story for the relationship between the Met and XR.
Yeah, I mean, the story goes back at least 10 years or 145 years, depending on who you're asking. You know, so we have the oldest running photography studio in museums in the whole world. And so we've been documenting our collection for public presentation, like books, websites, things like that, as well as for conservation. So thinking about, you know, different kinds of imagery to understand pigment or underpainting and things like that. We've been doing that for a super long time. That team has been doing 3D scanning for a little bit over a decade, hence the 10-year piece. And it grew out of those same areas of practice, really actually focusing on the conservation. In the last kind of, I have to do a fact check on myself, in the last 6 years, we started thinking about those for public presentation, you know, as it became easier to think about things like, you know, WebXR or platforms like Eighth Wall, where we could do things without a download, like as sort of frictionless as possible, and say, what is it like to give people these 3D models, bring them into their own spaces. Our first things were happening, like many museums in the pandemic, so trying to kind of be there, kind of in people's spaces. But again, as I was saying before, like, what are the different affordances and ways that we can tell, you know, stories that these kind of pieces unlock? I mean, you go to a museum and you can't pull something off the pedestal. You can't go inside the case. So sometimes it's very simple, but then being able to see something in its original context or see it in full color, see it in dialogue with objects across spaces and across time, you really start to unlock really different stories that, you know, as a museum that has, you know, collects contemporary art and has Paleolithic tools that are 20,000 years old and everything in between, it's a really powerful unlock for us that are really interested in those kind of like cross-temporal and cross-cultural juxtapositions as well.
And maybe you can also share a bit more context to like some of your first encounters with virtual reality, augmented reality, some of these immersive technologies. Like, what was the turning point for you to get more into this on your own personal journey?
Gosh, I'm trying to go back. I was just trying to remember the other day, like the name of the original piece. I mean, so really it was like, again, fact checking myself, maybe it's like 17 years ago or 16, we were doing some work. I was at this place called the Rocco Group Lab, and this is where we're doing a lot of experiments in space. So we're working on like Google's office and doing things for Intel and all these like different corporate clients and just doing stuff with like fiducials, you know? So it was this funny thing of like, holding, you know, essentially like a version of a QR code in front of a camera and seeing a virtual object come to life. And it was really cool and really magical and really weird. You know, we like couldn't figure out exactly what it was for, but we were in the space of like, there's something kind of there, you know? And then when I started, especially working in the cultural space at the last place I was at called Blue Cadet, you know, we started talking to people like, you know, American Revolution sites, you know, that wanted to think about what is it like to go to a space where a battle was fought and see it in a different way, see it come to life. Again, doing the work with the Met of thinking about like, how do you bring these sort of places, these pieces into your world, and having the technology come that far from like, I was, you know, we're doing like compiling C++ libraries and printing out these weird QR codes to suddenly being able to do like these quick ship, you know, web-based experiences. That was like the big kind of journey. We did a lot at Blue Cadet, an early kind of even AR kit project for iOS for this museum called Henry Ford. We did like a lot of these sort of like build your own object experiences too. So I guess my shorter answer is like, especially in the AR world, kind of have touched every kind of genesis of that. And then VR for me as a person really has been more recent. Like, I've tried almost every generation of headset, and I hope I don't offend any of your listeners, but for me, it was like the most recent Quest that really got me there. Cause I was like, oh, okay, this is at a price point that can be more comfortable for people. The fidelity is like pretty good. The pass-through is pretty interesting. All the kind of ingredients were sort of there, along with all the things that have come, you know, before it, of like the ease of production, you know, being able to go via like WebXR or Unity, like just so many of the things that I had been able to do in the past, that got me much more interested in headsets. And candidly, like, I started the Met 3 years ago. Almost every museum of our size and scale and history has done a VR project. And I was like, well, we can't have not done anything. We need to learn. We have, you know, hundreds of models. We have all these great stories. Like, the time is now, it has been now for a bit to do something in a headset specifically too. So I'm just kind of saying, I'm talking a lot about AR and not a lot about VR, you know, but that was kind of my journey really, is thinking about, especially because I've been doing so much stuff in public, in communal spaces. That's where I started with AR. But I really feel like there's a lot there when it comes to that, really both, like thinking about something that can work on a phone, that can work in a headset, that can work in kind of these in-between spaces and like WebGL. And then eventually, like, obviously thinking about glasses and stuff like that now as well.
Awesome. Yeah. And just to get a better sense of the timeline. So you've been there for 3 years, and was there any XR before, or did you come in to start this program? And just maybe just talk a bit more around your role and, you know, kind of what you were coming into and what was the intention for the different type of stuff that you were kickstarting?
Yeah, great question. So yes, did there being other XR before, which I think has been really cool. I mean, so we did two projects, one very small and one very big during the pandemic that I did not work on, that were really like WebXR, like pushing the limit. So one was really like a virtual visit to the museum. And it was just that time, like we were closed, people wanted to experience it. And that was a really cool, big kind of project. At the same time, our imaging team did their first, like taking one object and putting it in like a USDC, like AR quick look feature with audio in English and Spanish. And the latter actually had the most kind of legs for us. Like, it was like, okay, we can see how we can do this work. We can pack like a little bit of interpretation, but pretty frictionless, obviously just on one device family to start, but you know, we're figuring that kind of stuff out too. And so, you know, I think that was the stuff that predated me. And then the one I was talking about earlier of the like seeing a Greek and Roman statue come to life in color, that was when I was on the other side of the fence. So I didn't work for the Met. I worked at a company called Blue Cadet, and we were kind of like building this stuff for the Met. So by the time I came in house, I was like, okay, well, we've done a few things. We've learned a lot from them of like, how much content is too much content? Where do you go back and forth between like, I mean, frankly, like no one wants to hold their phone out in front of them for 15 minutes. Like, I don't know. I don't go to the gym enough to be able to do that. Most people are in a similar case. There's other reasons why too, but trying to like learn from those things and have a different dialogue, especially when you think about on-site AR. But, you know, as I was saying a little bit before, like starting 3 years ago and being like, okay, well, we haven't done anything in headset. We have this huge backlog of content. And mind you, just really this May was the first time we put those 3D models even on our normal website. So they're just incredible amount of content that are really detailed. Like our team is doing posts on the roughness maps, like the metallic roughness. So everything looks as real as possible, but no one had seen it. So it was like, let's open the floodgates, you know? So a lot of things came before me. Really, I was just like a bit of like a pain in the butt to like be like, we got to get this stuff out there, you know, more than anything, kind of unlock the rest of the team's creativity in a way.
Yeah, as I know with a lot of different museums, there's what's on display for the public, but also like often a huge archives of stuff that often is for space reasons not available. So is that some of the stuff that kind of digitizing some of that and making it available virtually? Is that what you were referring to?
Yeah, totally. And it's a big mix. I mean, yes to the archives, but also like, you know, for example, working on one WebXR project right now, it's this archaic Cypriot priest that is like a 7 foot tall statue. And all the evidence that it was in color is on its hat, and it's on a plinth. So it's essentially like 10 feet away from you, right? So like, there's no way for you as a visitor, unless you like go rogue and bring in your own ladder, for you to like see this piece, right? So sometimes it's as simple as like bringing something down to human scale or bringing it off the pedestal. Like it's about that modality and about that access. And then you're absolutely right. From there, the idea of like, where are both our collections and our archives, which are different. I won't go too much into the museum mechanics there, but like there's so much we can activate to give people access and understanding. You know, I mean, the reason museums have these big holdings is to tell different kinds of stories and different kinds of things that we can do in person too, I think.
Nice. Yeah. I'm curious to dig into the storytelling aspect at some point, but I first want to also maybe go through chronologically the different types of projects that you're working on just to get a sense of the diversity and what you were able to do in the last 3 years. So maybe as you're coming in 3 years ago, after you were working through a contractor to work on previous projects, what were some of the first projects that you wanted to do there? And also whether or not some of these projects were done in-house or whether or not you're sort of contracting out to coordinate some of these things.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, the first copy I'll say is like XR is just like a piece of my portfolio, you know? So coming in 3 years ago, obviously one of the big questions on everyone's mind was AI. So the first two projects I did, one was another collaboration with our Greek and Roman department that was like a 3D and XR piece that's in gallery that we just built off the learnings from this previous project. So that was almost exactly 3 years ago now. And the second was a collaboration with OpenAI that was like a chatbot with this dress. And it's this piece that in some ways has things in common with XR, which is that it was an object that we knew a ton about and we had to boil down to like, you know, 150 character label. And it's a very common problem in museums where there's just so much you want to tell people. And there are long form, you know, there's books, there's podcasts, there's things like that. But we want to offer people different modalities. So we did this chatbot to say, you can talk to this dress because we know about who wore it. We knew everything about her life. She was a relative of the famous artist, John Singer Sargent. We also knew about the people who designed the dress. We had built a custom mannequin based on a Brancusi sculpture. We did some conservation work. I could go on and on, but there was like so many different lenses that you could jump to dig into. And so, and that one honestly was like a very small collaboration. So that one, we have a digital product team and it was a web-based experience. So we built that part in-house with support from some applied AI engineers at OpenAI. And then, gosh, I feel like I can't tell you everything because it will just run out of time, but like, you know, my big threads have been like iterating around what is the right use for AI on-site and at home. That is that intersection of like helping us tell the stories you want to tell, but giving people things that they want and kind of need. So we've been iterating on that chat concept, making it bigger and bigger, constraining it to met scholarship and knowledge, you know, building off of that smaller XR projects. The one I was talking about, the bigger piece that we launched in November, that was about a year-long process. We worked with this partner, Atopia, who are both the platform and the production arm, but doing things like scanning our the Temple of Dendur, which is one of our most famous objects. It's the size of a room. We still did that scan in-house. So it was a three-week photogrammetry scan. It's a beast. But we built... The reason we did it in-house is we wanted to have it for our archives. You know, so our researchers are doing more research on the model instead of having to touch the physical objects. There's a lot of reasons we do things kind of in-house on that way. Gosh, what else should I highlight? And then, I mean, I think the three most recent things I'm really excited about are similar but different threads. So we just did a Google-funded technologist in residence that was focused on on-site AI. So thinking about what's possible, what's good, and what do people want. We're publishing a little bit more about that in the middle of July, but we did about 30 prototypes in 6 months. Every single one was user tested on site, which was insane.
Is that all used like Google Gemini, like ways that you could sort of integrate it into different experiences?
That's exactly right. It's everything except for chatbots. So there's a lot of, we did scavenger hunts, we did itineraries, we did camera-based experiences. It's kind of like all over the place. And we feel like we have a really good, you know, state of the union of what's working right now, which is really cool. And then we just opened this exhibition called Musical Bodies that has a giant 60-foot by 6-foot in-gallery interactive where you can make music with your body. And it's like three giant projectors that map your movement to interactive projection too. So it's interactive sound, interactive visuals, and it's an exhibit about how your body is an instrument. So what better way to do it? So really thinking about like, what are things that you can do at home, on your phone, on your computer, or on your headset? What are things you can do in gallery, either kind of like as a solo traveler, again, probably on your own device, but thinking about communal interactions as well. So that kind of like pseudo immersive that we sort of have, you know, that I'm talking about with musical bodies. And then what are the ways we can kind of, you know, stretch that into things that are kind of in between. So we're even doing bringing our at-home VR on site through like public programs. So a lot of just different ways we're activating the collection. I could keep going, but I feel like there's a lot of fun stuff.
Yeah, let me just interject in terms of a quick question around the AI, and then I want to dig into more of the VR stuff after that. But so in terms of a lot of the large language models, in terms of when you're interacting with them, sometimes if you're just dealing in the realm of information, then it could potentially be uncontrollable and hallucinate. And so I know there's like solutions like nworld.ai that tended to be a little bit of like, here's our knowledge that you can refer to and that you can maybe have a conversational interface. But there's a bit of a check and balance in terms of ensuring that it's not just making up stuff. And so I'm just curious if you ran into like AI hallucinations or like what ways were you trying to find things that you could say are the ground truth that you could refer to without having it hallucinate, if that's just a part of the context window, or if there are other toolings like inworld.ai that attempts to have a little bit more control over the flow of a conversation and a narrative arc, but also contain the knowledge to not go beyond certain bounds.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I mean, I think for us, there's this huge like risk and opportunity with AI, right? Like museums are among, there's like survey after survey that museums are one of the most trusted public institutions for most people. And there's this other thing of more and more people are getting their information from AI. So for us, we're like, okay, we see this opportunity to kind of like open ourselves up and like make sure there's good content there. And we see this opportunity for AI to help us essentially wade through. I mean, we're 156 years old. We've been doing publications since day one. So long form writing. There's so much content we've created, and AI is a way to kind of wade through and mine that is a great opportunity. But that trust aspect is the big risk, right? We can't lose that contract we have with our visitors. So going back actually to your question, you know, there's, I think, two main threads we think about with AI. So one for sure is the knowledge base, like constraining. And we do RAG, like retrieval augmented generation, or other kind of processes that exactly as you said, like inject stuff in the context window. And it says like, okay, you know, we're doing this one in July. We can talk to like the statue of Mary Magdalene, for example. And if you have a question about Mary Magdalene, the person or the specific statue, you may inject something there and we just constrain it. If you say, you know, tell me about the Knicks game 5, it won't answer that question as much as we would love it to answer that question. But no, so we constrain like what can it answer and really grounding it in factual information. But part of my role is like building these bridges and understanding like what it takes to do these projects. And as anyone who's doing AI at scale with huge data sets will tell you, like, it is not so simple as just like open the floodgates to everything. There's scaling issues, there's data conforming. So even doing these last two chat projects have been really eye-opening as far as like what it takes for us to make something that is truly performant and also just truly interesting to people. That's like a big piece of the puzzle. And it's not just like flip a switch and give all your data AIs. We wouldn't do that anyway. So again, first one is constraining the knowledge. The second one is thinking about like, what are new opportunities, especially with things like vision language models, VLMs, that while I wouldn't say they're objective, but they do give you an opportunity to do something that is lower risk of hallucination. So, you know, we built this actually, this super quick prototype, and Julia Dowser is our technologist resident. So Julia made this prototype of almost like a AI voice meditation. And it uses this agentic vision thing that Gemini does, where essentially like breaks up an artwork into like a million tiny tiles and describe each one in detail. So you listen to the meditation and it's really just like, notice the gold scallops. And mind you, the one-on-ones we did, for example, it's like a 3-inch by 5-inch painting. It's so small, but it's gilded. It's so intricate. There's tile work. And all it's doing is guiding your eye. It doesn't say what the pattern means, the historic context, but it's really powerful in helping you just like engage richly and asking questions. So there's definitely a middle ground between those two, but I think both of those are performing really well for us. And I think our visitors are finding really interesting too, because it's just like a little bit of like handholding, you know, and pulling you through these interesting details. So that's one way that we're kind of doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and imagine that there could be some of that used for accessibility purposes. Is that something that you are generating in terms of like having audio captions or visual descriptions? And imagine that there's an art of doing that by a human doing that. And then how much do you want to let the AI take care of some of that? So to what degree are you cultivating, curating something with that human editing, or at least done in collaboration where it's got someone who is a subject matter expert who may be able to also check and balance it? So yeah, just curious to hear what kind of accessibility things you might be digging into on that front.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. It's definitely one of the next things that will be releasing. So we're working on semantic search on our website, which is actually powered by AI generated descriptions kind of under the hood. We're doing vector embeddings of those to do the search. Our engineer Derek Au figured out this great process for that. So it's really cool. But of course, if we are describing 500,000 images, that idea of accessibility comes up almost immediately. And the first thing we'll say is like, a long form visual description is definitely not the same as a curatorial interpretation, right? It aims to be, I think the Cooper Hewitt Museum has some of the best guidelines out there about really you're trying to be as objective as possible. There's very clear rules about perceived gender, perceived race, activities. Like you're really trying to just guide somebody through the physical experience of seeing it, which seems kind of perverse if you're doing it for accessibility, but that's really like what it's built upon. So yes, we're doing that. And right now we're working in the process of involving the community. Cause for me, it's like, we don't want this to be a token effort and say like, oh, you know, we're only relying on AI to do these things for a certain audience, but also this idea of like, it's 500,000 images and growing. Like, can we really use the things that AI can unlock are doing these pieces at scale that suddenly we can open up the whole collection. I think that's where the opportunity is. And then finding these moments to add in the human in the loop. So we're building these like nice, simple kind of review tools, doing a lot of tuning the prompt. There's a lot of questions. There's awesome stuff in this realm. The National Gallery of Art in DC and the Cleveland Museum of Art in Cleveland both launched AI generated and assisted descriptions, and they're great. So there's a lot of great precedence in this space as well.
Well, you mentioned briefly a little bit of the VR projects. I think you said like the musical bodies, but maybe you could just go into a little bit more detail as to what kind of headset-based VR experiences that Matt has been doing.
Yeah, so we have these two different pieces. It's via this platform called Atopia, who are kind of like our production partner as well. And so if you have a Quest 2, 3, or 3S, you can just find this in the Horizon store. And they're two really different experiences. So one is about our collection, the Arts of Oceania. So the region that includes New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, the Torres Strait Islands, this huge network of islands. And we have a really unique collection of those. We just reopened a gallery dedicated to the arts of that region. So when everything went off display, we scanned everything. So we have a ton of great photogrammetry and just a ton of great storytelling. So we work with people from the region. So you get into this virtual space, you hear a song from Dr. Michael Mel from Papua New Guinea, who's like a scholar, a performance artist, sort of like a jack of all trades, amazing person. And he welcomes you to the space and talks about what it's like to be in this region and what this region's about. And as you move through, you have this sort of intersection of newly created virtual architecture with these sort of photogrammetry scans placed in it. So trying to do this thing where like objects that were in dirt in the original context are in virtual dirt in the space, but you're also in this thing that kind of feels like a gallery. And then all the sound you're hearing, or I would say most of the sound you're hearing, is archival audio from the region that actually our original curators and researchers recorded like in the 70s. So it's actually this way, it's kind of like mining our archive too. So you can walk through this virtual space. You can either just enjoy it as it is, or each object has what I call like a content pool. So you can just look at the object in 3D, or you can either hear a story from a person in the region. We work with this contemporary photographer, for example, that shows how one object is made and worn. There's like a 360 film. There's like so many different things. And for us, it was really like, this is the closest to what I would call a traditional virtual tour, and offering something that is in some ways actually kind of expected, you know, but building off of that. Like, it's different than what you can experience in person. It's a lot of different ways to engage with objects, but it's really free form. Whereas the second one, the Temple of Dendur, that's a deep dive into one of our most famous objects. So it's a Roman era Egyptian temple, which is already like a kind of thing you have to wrap your mind around. And it deals with kind of what I was talking about earlier with the AI chatbot, like the idea of layers of meaning on an object, you know? So we try to answer the big questions like, why is it called the Temple of Dendur? What does Dendur even mean? Who are the people or the gods like depicted on the temple? Why is there graffiti in the temple? And then why is it at the Met in the first place? Like, this is, should this be in Egypt? Why is it here? Things like that. And then doing things that you can only do in VR. So you can walk inside the temple. We don't let you do that in person. You have a flashlight, but again, doing things with a narrative purpose. So the flashlight is actually connected to how priests would have originally walked into the temple with a candle. So really trying to do these things kind of implicitly. Like, we don't spell every single thing out for you, but it's really a free explore. So the first one is about like, it's a four-act experience. The first act is like digging into the temple now. The second one, you step through this portal and you're into, you know, early 20th century Nubia on the shores of the Nile, and you learn why the temple is here. It's a story we've told many times over the years, but it's one that doesn't always click with people. So we're showing you the reason it's here is actually it was underwater and it's about to be under way more water. So there's a mix. It's almost like an interactive documentary. That part's a 360 3D film with these kind of interactive moments where you can look more deeply at some of the archival materials. You can see film from, you know, the UNESCO-based rescue effort, and you can see the temple actually be submerged and hear about why it's here. And we also talk about the displacement of the Nubian people, who also, their villages were submerged as well. So we worked with, we had the song by Hamza al-Din, who's like a songwriter from the region, whose all of his performances were based around that story. He also is the first person who performed at the Temple of Dendur in the 1970s. There's a lot, I mean, that's like an Easter egg that nobody will get, but heard it here first, I guess. And then the third act is you're back in New York and helping put the temple back together and trying to answer again those questions of like, you know, how did the Met do it? How did people in ancient Egypt do it? And then we tell you some of the kind of like secrets about the hidden rooms, these like different details of the temple. So really trying to unfold that mechanic over time. That one, if you've played Crafting Crimes, it's actually like ended up being a very similar mechanic, very serendipitously. But I love that there's this kind of play where you like build, build story. And the last act is really just like meditative. You're just in a dark gallery. You're just there. You can leave a voice message or you can just kind of like vibe. You know, it's like a really open space. We work with the composer to do music for all four of the acts. And really with those ones together, and again, this is sort of a long answer to your short question, but like, you know, we wanted to do things that were very experientially different to just talk about not only like have different data, right? Like, you know, virtual tour versus like levels, game, things like that. But also, again, just like alluding to what it's like to be at a museum. Like sometimes you go to a museum and just like fall in a rabbit hole and you're like, oh my gosh, I like only stood in front of this one painting for like 2 hours. And sometimes you kind of move around and the story is more about like the combination of all the above. So I hope that people kind of get that if they do sort of both experiences.
And so are both of these experiences, were they ever meant to be exhibited at the Met, or were they meant to be distributed through like the store on Meta's Horizon store?
I mean, these were super focused on at home, right? So there's no, like, if we had done it more for on-site, we would have kind of probably thought more about mixed reality. So you have like the communal aspect and pass through augmented layers and things like that. But really, like, we know there's barriers to getting to the Met. Like, you have to get to New York. It's one of the most expensive places in the world to visit. It's a tough time for travel for everybody, like all these things like that. So this is really a part of an effort just like to bring the Met to more people in more places. And so whether you're trying it on the web in WebGL, or you're trying in your headset, it's really meant for at home. But we have done on set, we also just acknowledge like not everyone has a headset. So we've done more like public programming. So a couple times, like we're late, we're open late on Fridays. So we'll set up in the gallery with like 15 seats with a headset on it. You can RSVP, it's free. And you just like get to experience the piece. It's a little bit odd, you know, because you're like experiencing like the virtual object where the real object's there. But of course you get different superpowers. You can't go in the temple. You can't pick up these objects. So people still really like it, even though sometimes they're like, that was kind of weird, but I did like it, but it was different. You know, like it's so targeted towards at home. It does sometimes feels weird when we do it in person, but I think it's still really worth it. Cause I just hearing from people like, I've never done VR before, you know, this is really cool. Is this what VR is usually like? I mean, like there's sort of big questions there, which is, it's very like specific to the US market, I think kind of, but yeah, that part's been really cool.
Yeah. And in terms of story and storytelling, I just wanted to get a sense of different ways you start to think about, like you said, you often have these objects that have like 150 words or whatever, they're these descriptions and brief labels, but there's so much more visual context that you could have. Each object has a spatial context that could be portabilized into sort of like augmented reality or mixed reality, or also you have the connections between the objects with each other, or you also have this idea of a group experience of somehow facilitating emergent social dynamics, perhaps in some ways having a shared group experience that have people feel like they have more of a collective experience rather than an individual experience. So I'm just curious to hear a little bit more around how you start to think about all the different vectors that you can start to weave in new forms of storytelling with XR and AI that you weren't able to really explore before.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, what a great question. And I will struggle to answer it briefly, like kind of all my answers. But like, I think the one thing to think about with the Met is we have this really huge and really diverse collection, right? It'd be really different if we were just a contemporary art museum or just a museum of Greek and Roman art or ancient Egyptian art or arms and armor and things like that. So each one of those collections has really different opportunities to understand, you know, what did an object originally look like? Where did it come from? Was it like, for example, we have one other XR project we've been talking about is we have this like amazing, beautiful, ornate fragment of a tile that is actually like a part of like a 30-foot tall, or was originally a part of a 30-foot tall column that was a part of a temple complex that was a Muslim temple, then a Christian church, then a, like a pagan place. You know, it's like the possibilities are just sort of like fractal in nature. Like the closer you get, the more complicated it gets. And so, you know, a lot of things we're thinking about are that, but I think that that communal thing I want to touch on too, you know, the projects that I didn't work on, but that were kind of Met XR engagements that I thought were really interesting is, you know, we did this show called Africa and Byzantium. So about kind of like these early Christian objects in, you know, areas like Ethiopia and things like that. And so with that one, we did a partnership. And again, this was before my time, but I just thought it was interesting. It was a partnership with the university. And they did like a virtual tour of this monastery that was essentially like in the desert. And I use this one as a case study all the time. So it was a HoloLens experience, not my favorite headset, but it was really helpful for people who hadn't done XR before because, you know, you could see people, things like that. And it was a facilitated tour. So it's a curator who brought everybody there. She moved them around the space so you could walk around freely. And then she would kind of bring you up in different levels and show you different things and have like a laser pointer. So there's this cool physical digital thing happening. But my favorite part was really like, you know, people ask me all the time of like, oh, you know, are your things only for kids or just teenagers or whatever? And I was like, look at this example. So if you forget about the XR part and say like, who are the people who would like to see an ancient Christian temple in a very inaccessible part in the desert? That was the audience. So it was actually a lot like of older people, very kind of like devout religious people, people who had never been in a headset before. And they really got a lot out of it. I mean, there were people who were literally just like, I'm 70, like I'm never going to make it this temple, but now I get to see this. So while all these different kinds of layering or different kinds of like understanding spatial context or even understanding like museum processes, like post and pre-conservation, there's so much we can do. Sometimes it's really just about giving people that different level of access. Like sometimes it's like the lowest hanging fruit is like the way to go because there's that sort of desire to kind of inhabit a story in a way, which I think is really cool.
Well, one thing that's been around for a long, long time has been like audio tours. Do you already have like a full set of like audio tours, which you could think of as a sort of a level of augmentation?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we have all kinds of audio tours, and audio tours are really great. You know, that when we think about prototyping the future of audio, we think about all the things you're saying. So one of the AI prototypes we made is just like an audio tour that's meant for like more than one person, which we haven't done before. So yes, we have them. And yes, we're like thinking about different ways that these new technologies can help nudge at these different sort of pieces.
Yeah. And there were some pieces that were at South by Southwest this year that had like vibe trackers that as you walk around, then it's sort of like you're walking through a spatial audio field, which I think is also really quite rich and interesting to think about. Like people wearing headphones, but having some sort of spatial tracking through a space that allows people to feel like they're walking through an immersive world in a way that there's a lot that you can do because our ears are actually the only sense that's like fully 360 degrees. We can only look forward in a way. So like our ears, we can like step into these sound fields that feel like we're able to achieve this level of immersion in a way that already has like existing technologies with like headphones, but you just need to have some sort of way to spatialize it and then create sort of the journey and experience through that. So I feel like that's something that I'm starting to see in terms of some folks that are doing that, but like possibilities that would open up new ways of experiencing the art as they're having this whole fully immersive audio experience.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, I'm doing the thing you're not supposed to do in an audio podcast and nodding a lot. So for the listener at home, picture my head rattling. But yeah, it is interesting. And I think, you know, there's this book called Augmented Human, and I'm going to butcher her last name, but it's Dr. Helen, and I can't remember her last name, but she wrote this great book and she talks about AR is not just visual, right? And audio or other extrasensory experiences are like a piece of that puzzle and can be. Again, I mean, I struggle a little bit with like, how do you do things and make them communal? But we do have a lot of like solo travelers, as we call them, who can really get a lot out of that audio. And that spatial piece is the sort of last frontier. I mean, we really lean a lot on web tech. In my past life, I've done things with like Bluetooth beacons that grow and move and change as you move through spaces. They're so magical, but people just like don't download apps in museums, unfortunately. So, you know, once those technical barriers shift or if it moves to glasses, I think there's so much to spatial aware, just in time, like heads up experiences. I mean, I think the danger, and we really think about this a lot, the danger of putting too many things in the phone is like maybe you're learning, whether you're like playing a game or reading something different about the art or talking to a chatbot, whatever, but then you get like a ping from your best friend, like, hey chat, what's up with my fit or whatever. Suddenly you're gone. You've lost that person. They're not in the space anymore. They're in the chat, you know? So we think about that with the phone and like, that's the drag, right? You end up in this heads down experience. So audio is great because of that, because you can be aware, because you can connect to something and because you can do the sort of guided listening. It's just thinking about, you know, the blessing and the curse of the med is we're very big, you know? So it's like, what do we do at scale? So we're really back in this sort of like pilot stage of like different kinds of audio and also just different kinds of audio in a similar way to XR, like in gallery versus at home. You know, so we've done some podcasts, we're playing in that space more as well. You know, like what are the ways to activate the whole suite of audio too? So.
Yeah, well, because XR is like one of these things that I've often heard that different institutions will look to XR as they want to reinvigorate different demographics that they may not be reaching in some ways. And so I've heard that time and time again from different folks that are working in these cultural institutions. So just curious to hear some of the early feedback in terms of like the metrics for success of like just seeing what you've been doing, what the reaction is, but also if it's able to potentially start to reach out to new audiences and new demographics.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say like, we think a lot, I'm borrowing from our CDO's metric, we think about like reach, engagement, and impact, right? And so reach isn't always like, oh, do we reach as many eyeballs as a YouTube video, right? Because that's like a really hard one to stack against. But it is like, do we reach those new audiences? And actually for us, it's been this sort of push and pull of even simple things like marketing, like the Met going to Reddit for the first time with ads and seeing like, okay, how do people in, you know, these different communities, like, are they engaging and does that kind of successfully bring people in? You know, is this experience engaging enough to hook people outside of the kind of like museum bubble? So it's really like, do we reach new audiences and do we reach kind of a threshold that kind of like, you know, the juice is worth the squeeze, as it were. And then the engagement is like the next piece, right? Like, you know, these things are very nuanced, they're very content rich, and they can be very like durational by design, at least the experiences that we did. And that part has been really heartening. I think the thing that I've been most excited about is we had this sort of like U-shaped engagement curve. So engagement, we're really thinking about like dwell time and how many times people came back to the experience. So most people come more than once, which is great, at least twice on average. And then the U is a little bit like the classic, okay, I came in and walked around for a minute and then I left. Like that's our first peak. There's a valley kind of in the middle. And then we're seeing the other side of the U, the like 5 minutes, the 10 minutes, the 15, the 30 plus, like that's the side that's growing the most. And then once we found the right niche of like, you know, going outside of our traditional Met PR channels and going to places like Reddit or working with like cool creators like Nathy and talking to his audience, we're seeing that engagement time go up, you know, and that's the part that I'm really excited about is we have like the last I checked on Reddit, like that group is like over 10%. So 1 in 10 people are in the 30 plus minutes, which we don't capture after that because that's just a lot. That's a lot of time. And, you know, we live like an intentional economy, right? So for us to say like people think it's worth it to spend time with the museum, like that's a lot to ask. And we really, it just feels like generous when people like want to give that to us. So that engagement is the thing we're really leaning into. Like, is it worth doing something in XR versus like a YouTube video or a social media post? Like, does the engage time high enough that it really feels like that's a meaningful interaction? And the last one is impact. That one's really hard to measure. And candidly, we are just sending out surveys. We don't have enough sample size for me to report back. So stay tuned. But that idea of like, you know, did it open up your understanding of what these collections are about? Did it change your perception of the museum? Are you just a person who's like, didn't know about the Met before? Like that idea of like impacting both our broad audience, but most interesting, like impacting people. And that is more, you know, that's qual, that's not quant. So it's taking time to like bring in that data, but that's what the other stuff we're kind of thinking about. And really my projects are weird. Like they're, you know, I did like a blockchain based game, right? And it was like, in a similar way, like the retro success was not, again, stacking up against traditional social media or whatever. It was like, did we bring in enough people from an outside audience? You know, and that one, 40% of our users came from the Coinbase app, which that was huge. That was so different than anything else we've ever done. You know, so trying to find those comparisons of like really, as you start to hint at, like open up with new demographics, new users, and just new places. Because we just think like the Met, and specifically in museums generally, are for everybody. But there's a lot of friction to like get in that door. So hopefully these platforms can like open that up for people.
Awesome. Well, as I start to wrap up, I have a few more questions. And so I guess one question is that I'm sure you've got many projects that you're baking and working towards. So I guess a way to frame how to talk about those, if you want, don't want to talk about specifics, but what are some of the biggest open questions or challenges that you feel like you are yet trying to solve with exploring the potential of some of these XR and AI technologies when it comes to what's next for what type of stuff you're working on?
Yeah. I mean, I think I sort of like two big things I'm working on conceptually, and big questions is a great way to frame it. So the first one is like, what is the right choreography of media in the on-site experience for people to feel like they had a enriching, unplugged, like very awe-inspiring and meaningful engagement with art that wasn't frustrating because they found something they couldn't like learn about it more, and it wasn't too like ush pushing stories, it was engaging enough. So it's really like, how can we find the right balance of like big immersive media, traditional like touchscreens and things like that, phone-based interactives, audio, small scale and large scale XR, glassesless displays. Like there's so many different tactics that we can employ in this choreography. And we don't want to tip the scales that people are like, oh, the Met is like a media museum, not like a physical art museum, because we will always be a physical art museum. So we want people to feel like that was cool. I saw the art. When I was confused, there was something there to support me. I did something that was like fun to kind of like, you know, reduce my cognitive load because, gosh, I've been here for 4 hours and I've read so many labels that my brain is broken. Like there's a lot of things that we can do if and when we get that choreography right. So that's one thing we're working on is like, what is our kit of parts and how does it work in the right way for the biggest amount of people on site? And then that second one is kind of following the thread of the VR projects we did, which is like, what is the best way for people at home to experience the Met? And in some ways, like, I'm just thinking a lot about like, the other extreme from these like very long, very high production value, very kind of intense VR projects, which is like, what is the next step beyond just here's a model and put it in your house, which we have like AR and all of our 3D models, but like, how do we add a little bit of content, a little bit of interpretation, a little bit of the spatial framing? Like what is the one secret sauce we can add that people felt like they had a meaningful connection to the Met at home, you know, from whatever that means, phone, headset, glasses, whatever form factor is coming. And I think that is the way that we will grow as a sector and grow our audiences, is help people understand like we are not a walled garden. We are not preventing you from like accessing art and creativity. We want to meet you on your own terms. And I think having things that are great in person, having things that are great at home, and cracking with both that communal aspect is the things that I'm really thinking about.
Yeah, I have a question about the phone and phone-based interactions, because was at IFA Doc Lab this year, and part of the theme of what the artists were talking about was getting off the internet. So not wanting to be connected. And I feel like when you're at the Met, when I'm at these places like the Met, I don't want to be on my phone as much. And so there's this kind of paradox of, if you think that phone-based interactions are, that can be sort of a portal for people to kind of hijack their attention and send them off into a dissociated state of escapism or some dealing with things that are outside of the concern of what's immediately in front of them in terms of the art. And so are you looking to, say, more head-mounted AR stuff to kind of like give an opportunity to have a little bit more immersive experience, but maybe free from all the different things that may be a black hole of trying to suck their attention away from what was happening in front of them? So just curious to hear how, if that's a trend you're also seeing in terms of like people wanting to be immersed and embodied and connected with each other and have a deeply immersive, engaging, participatory experience without having to deal with their phone at all.
Yeah, it's sort of like a two things are true moment, right? Like, we hear so much that people want to be unplugged and engaged, but then we've done a big kind of scientific visitor mapping project. And the two biggest valleys of frustration for us, one is just wayfinding. So people want something that's not just a physical map to get around. And two is this one that we just broadly called learn more, that they found something they think was cool and they couldn't find out more about it. You know, so what we're trying to do is think about, like, again, what is the kit of parts of tools we can employ that are, you know, whether it's a phone. And again, I think the phone is the biggest reach for now. But, you know, when we think about this idea of like proof of concept to prototype to pilot to project, being in this sort of like prototype pilot space with glasses, like as a interface to access this content because of the heads up nature, like that's definitely the thing we're thinking about. But it's, I mean, I'll give you a simple example. Like the chat project we're working on in July, we don't do the engagement hook. We just give you the answer and that's it. It doesn't say, you want to ask me about this, want to ask me about that, because we don't want to create that feedback loop, actually. Like, we know people are curious. We give them the list of the things they can ask, and it can go as long as you want. After about four or five questions, we were like, hey, why don't you go explore the gallery? You know, and a lot of the answers by design are like, look up and notice my cup in my hand. So that kind of ethos is the thing we're trying to do. It's, you know, it's not so easy. We can't control your mom texting you or whatever, right? But thinking about the heads up nature, thinking about not an endless feedback loop is, I think, really important. And I think it's as true of glasses as the phone, right? Like, if I'm in my, you know, I'll use like Meta Display as an example. Like, if I'm always putting something on display, that is not really a heads up experience still. That's like a funky focus with your eyeball, like looking at this thing. No one would suggest they do that. But just, you know, I think it's still trying to find that balance is, I think, super important, you know?
Yeah, it reminds me of an interview that I did with Francesca Panetta of 6x9, and it's about a solitary confinement. And she was saying that they were having interviews of people talking about their experiences of what it was like to be in solitary confinement, and that she found that what worked better was that to use this second person language of saying, you look at this here and you'll notice this. And so it's actually more grounding for people to be embedded into the experience rather than listening to a voice of God, dissociated voice that takes them out of the experience. So it sounds like that you're doing a little bit of that, of like, notice this and become even more present to things that you are able to bear witness to that you may have missed.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're even doing that with our touchscreens. We're really like rethinking all of our, again, traditional gallery media, and this idea of like heads up and heads down, and really being like, our ethos is like heads up, heads down, optional. Like, there's nothing that you have to engage with media. You know, there's this ways that story emerges in other ways, and it's not tech for tech's sake. So if it's in a touchscreen, if it's in your glasses, in a phone, whatever it is, like, there's a reason for it being. It couldn't be achieved in a traditional other museum sort of fashion. And I think it's like a tough rubric to follow. You know, sometimes it's annoying to follow your own strategy, but I think that's what's going to have, you know, the best outcomes for our visitors, you know, for sure.
Awesome. And finally, what do you think the ultimate potential for all these immersive technologies from XR and AI and what they might be able to enable?
I mean, it's hard not to like repeat myself a little bit. Like, I think when it comes to the in-person experience, it's having just-in-time, spatially aware, communal, interactive, playful, and awe-inspiring. So just, you know, along this there, you know, storytelling, and especially ones that empower like a polyvocal or multiple perspectives. I think that is the role of storytellers, is there's moments that are important to like have big perspectives, but it's a moment in time to like offer new perspectives and new takes on this thing. So, you know, that's my dream for, you know, XR in the museum, or all these things coming together, is just being like, I walk around and And maybe I didn't say heads up on the list, but the heads up is the crucial part. Like, I walk around and I'm just enjoying art. And then when I'm like, what is this? I don't get it. Or, oh my gosh, this thing is so amazing. I need to know more about it. That's your moment to like dive in. And it's really, again, in that choreography and that dialogue of the real. And more bonus if you can say like, okay, you know, I have 2 little kids. I'm like, hey, buddy, like notice this little thing. Or like, let's go to I Spy or Scavenger Hunt and all these things. Like that idea to like, it becomes an in-person interaction is like that sort of next step. And then again, I think when it comes to that at home, you know, it can meaningfully have this choreography with your traditional media too, right? Like when does it go between like your headset, your TV, you know, your headphones, like the way that the story can kind of emerge spatially. And again, feels like authentic to that mix of media that people have at home, you know, but it feels like, oh, this is like a virtual visit, but it's something different, I think, is the real kind of like end goal or ideal state, and kind of like allowing people to kind of simmer and immerse in these stories in a way that is essentially sometimes most appropriate either at home or in like an LBE. Like it's very different than like an in-person experience with physical art. So I think, I don't know, I could go on, but I think those are really like, for me, the ideal cases.
Awesome. Anything else left unsaid you'd like to say to the broader immersive community?
Oh my gosh. I mean, reach out if you want to work together. I mean, I think that's the big thing. Like, you know, we asked this question earlier, like when do I partner and things like that? And part of my role is to be able to bring some of this early ideation in-house, but it's also to build a network of collaborators, you know? So yes, we work with awesome, you know, people at the big tech companies, but really curious about independent creators and how we can think about a lot of different takes in the technology. You know, we are not, because I work on XR and, you know, cultural heritage and 3D and AI and blockchain and all the different things, I'm a master of none in a way, you know? And so meaningful partnerships and meaningful collaborations, whether that's individuals, universities, companies, whatever, that is the power that we kind of bring in all these perspectives and can really bring experts in and bring their expertise to bear with our niche. Like museums are a niche and there's a lot of, you know, things you need to know in working with museums. And that's part of my role is to like build those bridges. So the shorter answer is like, if you think you have something interesting, if you think you have something like really new, if you disagree with any of my hot takes or not so hot, very long extended takes, please reach out.
Awesome. Well, Brett, thanks so much for joining me here on the podcast. It's really exciting to hear all the variety of different things that the Met has and this vast collection of art and kind of like a endless possibilities for where this could go here in the future. So thanks again for giving a little bit of a retrospective look at what you've done already and where you might be going here in the future. So thanks so much.
Thank you so much. It was great.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Voices of VR podcast and for keeping the faith for where this industry is going here in the future. I feel like this is a kind of a weird time for everybody in the industry. And if you believe in where this technology may go and that it may be able to bring about positive social change and transformation in the world, then please do consider supporting me here at the Voices of VR podcast, trying to navigate these dimensions of transformation and positive change for where all this might be going. So if you enjoy the coverage that I'm doing here, then please do consider becoming a member at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.